Right, I think we can wrap that one up, and we'll make sure we make the point about the substantive nature of it, and we'll try and help you with some colour in terms of the scope of 5520, and we'll use the basis as much as we can to do that rather than inventing new words. All right, which leads us on to revolving credit facilities, paper 4. And Bernadette, you again.
So agenda paper 4 addresses two issues raised by one of our submitters regarding the application of the impairment requirements to a portfolio of revolving credit card exposures. So following on really from part of the discussions that we've been having on agenda paper 1. So there are two issues addressed here. So I'm going to summarise the first issue and then ask for your views before moving on to the second. So the first issue relates to the determination of the appropriate period to consider when measuring expected credit losses. And as noted in the other agenda paper that we've just been discussing, for specific financial instruments, such as certain portfolios of revolving credit facilities, IFRS 9 does permit a period in excess of the contractual commitment period to be used as the maximum period to consider when measuring your expected credit losses. And IFRS 9 also goes on to provide guidance about how an entity should determine that appropriate period. And so the submitter questions the application of these requirements in the context of a large portfolio of revolving credit facilities held by a bank. At the reporting date, the bank has identified that 75% of the portfolio has not suffered an significant increase in credit risk and is considered to be in stage one. 20% of the portfolio has suffered a significant increase in credit risk and is considered to be in stage two. And furthermore, within that stage two portfolio, it's expected that half of the assets within that portfolio will go on to default, whereas the other half will most likely cure. And the remaining 5% of the portfolio are credit impaired and are considered to be in stage three. So the example then goes on to describe the various credit risk management policies of the bank, how it determines whether there's been a significant increase in credit risk and the credit risk management actions that might be undertaken when such an event occurs. And the submitter asks then how to determine the appropriate period over which to measure expected credit losses for assets in each of the individual stages, and questions whether it might be appropriate perhaps to have different periods depending on the different stages. So having considered that issue, we would just make the following points before opening this up for discussion. So the appropriate period over which to measure expected credit losses for assets in all stages must always represent the period over which the entity is expected to be exposed to credit risk, and expected credit losses would not be mitigated by the entity's normal credit risk management actions. And also, once an entity estimates that appropriate period using the guidance in IFRS 9, the measurement of expected credit losses then follows the general guidance set out in IFRS 9. So there will still be a requirement to measure lifetime expected credit losses on all financial instruments for which there has been a significant increase in credit risk since initial recognition, and also 12-month expected credit losses, which are still a portion of lifetime expected credit losses on financial instruments for which there has not been a significant increase in credit risk since initial recognition. So having made those points, we would just like to seek your views on the issues raised by the submitter and the specific questions about the determination of that appropriate period for the assets in each stage.
Now, I think what we're planning to do here is, well, I'm hoping the ITG is really going to come into its own, is this is for people lucky enough to have got into the scope of 5520. Who are then sent to BB539. And what I thought would be good would be if some of the banks could talk to us and explain to us how, when they're implementing IFRS 9, they're thinking about applying the words we have in the standard to determine what the life is that they should be using to apply the standard. So, Bill, were you going to kick that off?
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Sue. So, no pressure.
No pressure, Bill.
Yeah, make it all clear.
So I was going to start, and if we deal with the measurement thing. Just to sort of say something about the fact pattern to start with, the fact pattern is in itself interesting because when you're dealing with revolving credit facilities, when you define an average life of 5 years, is that when the account closes? Is it when it runs to zero and there are no further drawdowns? Is it something else that, that people have in mind? Because typically with the revolving credit facilities, and then I'll come back onto the fact pattern, the nature of the product is such that the actual duration will be potentially much longer than that. And if you think about it, and we'll talk about it in the second part of the question, but it's relevant in terms of the consideration of the measurement. You'll have a credit card potentially for many years. So you would probably segment the portfolio into these sort of different sections or categories for the measurement. But if we take 1A, which is the and I think at its core to all of this is you're looking at what's the probability of default, what's the exposure that you're expecting if the account were to default, so how much are you expecting to have drawn down at each of the period dates, and then what is the loss expected on recovery, even if that would extend beyond the sort of 12-month time horizon. And so a simplified way of thinking about the stage one, or 1A to the question, would be you would just take a PD at month 12, and then you would multiply what you thought that the exposure was likely to be, multiplied on again by the loss you're expecting on recovery. In stage one, you're clearly guided towards the average life, which is 2.5 years. The way you would probably operationalize this, then I'm actually in Jorg's camp from earlier on. You would do this calculation on a sort of monthly basis, and you would look at the patterns of drawings and undrawns for each of those sort of monthly period snapshots, if you will, and then take them forward. One discussion point that we've had, and I know it's been discussed at industry level, is discounting and how you deal with that. It's quite clear from the standard that you're expected to discount back to today's values, recognizing that some future money is not the same as money received today. But when you're operationalizing it in stage one, would you continue to discount? And I think, is it necessary to discount? As opposed to would you continue? And so I think there would be, you would probably test for that in terms of whether it's there. Into the stage two elements, where you've got from the fact pattern 50% expected to have default, then it's quite clear that you would take life for those, which from the facts would be 4.5 months plus whatever the recovery period is that you would add on for going beyond there. And for the stage, for the 50% of the stage two that expected to cure, then you would take that out to the 2.5 years as the example cited in the paper, to have some sort of blended estimate of what the best guess of the loss would be from those separate sort of components. Because remembering and recognizing that you're dealing with probabilities at that stage, you don't know which of the population are going to actually go on to default and which are the ones which are actually going to come back into the in order population and cure. There was a supplementary question in there about what do you do with the question, with those accounts which cure and then subsequently go back into stage two. And we would certainly see that as a future event to be dealt with in stage two. But you need to check your sort of measurement stats that those, the 50% default banding that you've applied does take into account those which will have cured and then defaulted at some future date. That makes sense.
Can I ask you a question, Bill?
Yeah.
So you refer to the expected life of 2.5 years quite a lot. And if I look at B5540, that feels like that's subparagraph A, so the period over which the entity was exposed to credit risk on similar financial instruments. How are you taking... This isn't a trick question, I'm interested.
No, no.
How can you explain how you're taking into account C, the fact that on a sort of monthly basis or whatever it is in the fact pattern, that you've got the ability to sort of see whether something's happening and to act as a result? How are you taking into account your sort of credit risk mitigation actions? Because if you look at the basis where it describes what the sort of idea was here, it wasn't purely behavioural, it was taking into account, you know, the period over which you're exposed to credit risk, taking into account your credit risk mitigation activities. So how is that being built into the analysis?
And that's why I say that the example is a sort of simplified example, because what you would do is once an account actually moves into stage two, you would start to monitor, manage it in a more dynamic, different way. And so in that example, if you're taking management actions, that's why you're getting a shorter sort of outcome period, and that's reflected in the modeled results which you're using as your basis for your fact pattern. So what I haven't done here is to sort of substitute, if you will, that sort of higher granularity that you would actually operate from. I've just tried to respond to the
So do you
question.
Mean do you, that the credit risk mitigation activities are sort of implicit in the two
and
they're
implicit
years?
In that's how I've understood the example, and that's how I've taken the example. So I've tried to stick to the example. Paul, did you want to
probably can I? To me, I think the important thing is trying to determine that expected lifetime. You know, and what do you use to, in which to base that expected lifetime? I do see the lifetime for expected credit losses being quite different to almost some of the way it's pictured here, which is more around life of the product. So the way we would look at doing it is looking at historically how that portfolio, because the only way you can do it is on a portfolio basis. So historically, looking at how your portfolio has behaved since point at which you originated the loan. And you'd look at, you know, after 1 year, what level of default or loss have you experienced, what level, you know, 2 years, etc. And being generally, you know, portfolio like this, most of your losses would come in the early stages since origination. And I think you've got to continue measuring until some point you feel the majority of the loss or the default has occurred. And that starts to define the period over which you experience credit losses. I think as soon as you've got some idea as to what you define as your lifetime, then it starts to become easy to determine what do you calculate. And stage one becomes quite easy. Stage two is the more difficult because you've got to consider that full lifetime until you reach a default position for stage two.
Yeah, it's almost at what point does it go into an absolving state, you know, so such that you're not seeing each month when you're doing your monthly projections, you're not seeing any incremental, you know, any significant incremental difference to the amount which is getting there. Once you've identified that population and that time period. And it will be different for the different sort of stratas or segments. Then I think that's what Paul said.
Oh, sorry, John.
Just the other bit. So I think the thing of, as Bill mentioned, trying to determine that lifetime, I think there's another bit to consider, is that it almost gives you your probability of default. What you recover once your account's gone into default, I think there's a different life expectancy and a different calculation for that, because as soon as you've reached that default point, your focus is around collecting cash flows, and that life of over which you collect cash flows could have a completely different period or makeup. So you have to be quite careful distinguishing the lifetime of the loan until you get to default compared to the actual recovery of cash flows, mm-hmm. should it reach a default position.
I'd agree with the comments about Bill and Paul. Really what we're trying to grapple with here is the extra or the added complexity that's added to these products, because we're looking at a behavioural life, if you like, as opposed to a contractual life. So we're trying to figure out what will be the period of what amount are we exposed to when we calculate our expected credit loss. And maybe if I look at it in stage one and then it rolls on to stage two and three, if you think about it in stage one, you'll in this example, the average life of the book is 2.5 years, so I think the average life of default is 18 months, if I can remember it right. But really we're looking at trying to calculate what is our 12-month expected credit loss for stage one. So we don't need to look at a period outside 12 months per se. Maybe you might look at recoveries past 12 months, but you're looking at a period within 12 months. But if you think about it, if you've got a loan, if you've got a credit card at the start of the year, you might want to think of how much will default in month one, how much will default in month two, how much will default in month three, how much will default in month four, and so on. Because the amount that defaults in month one will be the balance at the end of the year plus what you expect to be drawn down between at the year end and month one. The amount that defaults in month six will be balance at the end of the year plus what might happen in the next 6 months. They could be two different things. Mm-hmm. So therefore you may need to look at an expected life of at the end of month for those that will default in month one at being a 1 month expected life, or it may be a 1 month expected life plus a 2 month recovery period, so you may be looking at over 3 months for the actual calculation. But certainly from the people I've been talking to, they kind of think that they may need to break down the probabilities of there being default on a monthly basis, and you have some sort of matrix type approach to determine the calculation, just so you can deal with that added complexity around determining what is the amount on which we have to calculate that. And then that flows on into lifetime expected credit loss, and it flows on, I think, to your question is 2.5 years, and I think Bill's right, it's way too simplistic. You'd have to probably do something similar for the lifetime, and then you'd have to look at cures. My own view is you should take into account the propensity of something failing, curing again, but you probably roll that up into your overall stats, as Bill said, your overall stats. What is my likely cure over the 2.5 year period, and then I'll apply that back. I think phase three is much more straightforward. You've terminated the card, it's just a straightforward calculation, I think. And I think the principle set out in the staff paper, I think, supports that kind of matrix type approach. I think to get it right, again, given by the guidelines of materiality, you have to get it to a point where you feel that you've broken those intervals down into an appropriate period. We're breaking them down any further, it doesn't make sense from a materiality perspective. And I think that's probably where the bigger decision is going to have to be taken.
Statistical perspective.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Steve?
This submission confused me with all these different periods. Isn't the 12-month allowance pretty simple? It's 12-month PD and then the lifetime loss weighted according to that 12-month PD. This seems to be overcomplicated.
But the question is, if you have a credit card and you're looking at the 12-month PD, but if you have the ability to have a credit risk management procedure at the end of month two. So let's say in month one the credit card's going to default, you'll stop it. So you're actually only looking at a 1 month period, because that is the period. And it was more, I think the question was more about how do I interlay the 12 month and the lifetime with the calculation of my expected life, or my expected life maybe in smaller buckets.
So I think, and I was going to ask a similar question. So my understanding, just to make sure we're all on the same page, is you're going to look at what the probability is of a default occurring over the next 12 months, and you might segment your portfolio in a way that makes it easier to analyse. Then when you're considering what the consequence of that default is, you're looking at what losses would arise over whatever time period that unfolds.
Yes.
Yeah.
Correct. Okay. Correct.
Okay. We're all on the same page then. All right. Did people have anything they wanted to add to that?
Then I will. If no one else. I think you mentioned paragraphs A, B, and C in B5.5.40. And what I've encountered in my own experience is that people focus on one of those paragraphs, and I know there's an and between them. And either they're in the school of, I monitor very closely, as I think they articulate in the example here, and therefore this should be measured in months. Mm-hmm. Or I'm looking at the behavioral life of a product which may have been going on for a long time, and things like overdraft features in current accounts. I've been with my bank and had a current account for over 30 years. Are they going to say that they should use periods that are measured in years, you know, 10 years, 15 years or more? And these are smart people all reading these words and yet coming up with radically different answers. And I think part of it is they're not looking at the and requirement. And there may also be the influence of regulators who perhaps have a point of view of how long they'd like you to try to forecast these losses. The longer the period, the bigger the reserves are going to be. And so I think, you know, to me, this question, above all the other questions you folks have posed, really does beg for more examples that try to do exactly what you asked, Sue, is if you're going to have a period, tell me how you tie it back to the paragraph C in the credit risk mitigation. Yep. And if you can't, like even in the example you guys have at the back that was in the standard, I think you used 30 months, there's really no logic as to why the 30 months was picked. What is, why wasn't it 24? Why wasn't it 36? Why wasn't it 5? And so I think if this is the one thing, I'd like to see more examples done that try to make that connection. Otherwise, whether it was intended or not, this behavioral life stuff seems to be kind of what people in credit world would otherwise like to try and use. And I don't personally think that's what you intended here, but I would be interested in your thoughts. I thought your question was a good one because that's what I want to ask my clients all the time too.
I want to listen to this discussion to see if it helps us in the first instance. But I guess if I can go back to the banks, and this is a bit mean because now I'm asking you to respond to George's question because I don't want to answer it. If you had the situation where you've got a portfolio of overdrafts, which, you know, some of which have a very long life, how are you taking into account the fact that this isn't just asking you what has the life been on instruments? It's saying also take into account your credit risk management actions. How are you reading that into this to bring us in shorter than 30 years, which was my understanding?
Shall I start? And would you? Yeah, so I guess the first thing I'd say is it's work in progress. So by which I mean we're doing some. We're at the sort of analysis design phase. We're doing some sort of model prototypes. We're taking different portfolios with different product characteristics to try and answer those questions. What we're doing is looking at what our historical experience. You know, it's no different to how you would construct any other sort of model. Insofar as you look at your historical experience over a sort of a time period, and then you project forward to what are the finite states that you can actually observe and measure. And so we mentioned a couple of those in terms of has the customer left, so there's clear closure. In which case, what were my loss experiences at that stage? Is it that the behavioural patterns have changed materially, significantly, so that I've got a different fact line? And then what we're trying to do is to understand what are the drivers of those differences from both a sort of a customer behavior, customer type, as well as a, let's call it a geography or sort of environment macro type. So I think it's no different in that regard, so in terms of how we're approaching it. Part of that is joining together our customer information in terms of what's actually a customer and account information with our collections and recovery data and the information and profiles from that. And then, George, to your point, it's how segmented does that become? It becomes segmented to the point where either you're managing it differently or the characteristics are sufficiently different that you would want it to be treated differently.
In response to what George has said, I think it's something we need to watch for sure, because I think it's one of the harder areas, and this is one of the reasons why moving beyond contractual is tricky. So it's narrow scope, but still obviously matters a lot. But the words in the standard say the period, it's not the period over which you expect the instrument to be outstanding. It says the period over which you expect to be exposed to credit risk. I wonder whether emphasising that in a summary would be helpful, and a reminder that this is an and, so you need to think about all of these things. Because what I'm hoping, and I won't aim this question at anyone in particular because that's probably unfair, so I'll speak to the banks generally, is what I'm hoping is that even if for an overdraft type such as George's overdraft, the expectation is that this instrument may well be outstanding for 30 years, you're not really exposed to credit risk over 30 years, because I'm presuming that if you're all active credit managers, you have lots of opportunities between now and year 30, if something goes wrong, to step in and say, I'm taking that line away. Yes?
Maybe to add to the bill, we are also in the process of analyzing, and I think what's important to really differentiate different types of clients and products, and also to think about in which stage we are on. So when we think, for example, a large corporate, they have credit facilities. I was told when one of these clients enter this the stage two, the time until they default is very often pretty short. So the time over where we have to calculate lifetime expected losses in stage two might be pretty short, because as I said, the time until the client then finally defaults is pretty short. So these are the fallen angels very often. This might be very different to mid-cap clients entering stage two until they finally default. So what I want to say is, I think in the context of implementation and finding the appropriate solution, we need to really look into how long we are really exposed to the credit risk until the client enters stage three. This might be a solution to find the appropriate application here.
Sorry, I missed the order of cards for Paul.
But I was just going to support that comment around it's important to emphasize that piece over which you experience credit risks. I think that's the important bit in terms of trying to determine how to actually work this out. I think you do have examples where you do have loans going out to 20 or 30 years, but realistically, you first of all, to measure or try and calculate over that period, it's just going to become unrealistic. You tend to find, as Jorg mentioned, is most of your credit risk will be in the early periods of the loan. Once you have an experience of somebody who's not had an increased credit risk for 20 years, there's generally very low probability of further credit risk. So you have to be practical around choosing a point at which you think the majority of the credit risk has been experienced. And you can't just practically go out to these sort of huge tiers.
Chris?
Maybe I'm just very slow, but I'm confused and don't really understand this distinction between the period over which you expect the instrument to be outstanding and the period over which you expect to be exposed to credit risk, because I read 5540 and I'd have thought the two were the same. I imagine, the period over, if the instrument's outstanding, you're exposed to credit risk, and your expectations around what will happen also will obviously reflect your credit risk management action. So I'm I'm just not getting the distinction that people are seeking to make. Unless this is just an argument to say, well, I don't really want to go out 20 years or 30 years because that's difficult or inconvenient, which I'm not understanding what the conceptual basis is for that. Some of the things I didn't quite understand around the example, maybe it's just loose wording. It talks about having these two sub-portfolios of things in stage two, those which are expected to default and those which are expected not to default. Whereas I get the impression they're not really sub-portfolios, you're looking at that bunch and you're saying, I think that 50% will default in the short term, and I think that 50%, well, they won't default in the short term, or they'll default in the short term and then cure. But they're not really sub-portfolios, they're just applying your statistical parameters across the whole pot of stage two. And then maybe just, tying into one of Paul's comments and the next issue you've got to deal with, it sounds like if you get a real heavy experience of losses early in the life of an instrument, that does suggest, well, that maybe that would be a separate portfolio. You know, you're going to have to model that separately. It's got different characteristics from something that's had a year's seasoning.
Yeah.
And I guess also the idea of how long the instrument is outstanding, maybe this is what the things you're getting at. You know, once you get into issue two, we seem to have a question around, well, when do these types of instruments, as it were, get de-recognised or considered to be new instruments? And I guess that might, you know, as you start looking out over a period of time and exposed to credit risk, I would imagine that if something got de-recognised under the analysis in issue two, then that would bring to an end its life for the purposes of 5540.
Martin?
Yeah. And my understanding why we have granted this exception, it was okay because we thought, okay, for this credit facility, that is really, if you can cancel it every day, the contractual period was is not appropriate. And therefore, we said, okay, because we have this problem also with undrawn, and therefore, I think we should come up with a kind of different time where we calculate really then the lifetime. But my understanding was it was only limited because what was told to us from banks is could we reviewing this kind of exposure maybe every year. And that is, if you're reviewing it every year, my understanding was if it is reviewed every year and then it found, okay, it is a problem with this, that is then cancelled. Yep. And if it is cancelled, I think there is not any exposure for credit risk, and therefore I think that is for me the maximum period. And I think, and therefore what Bill said, I think when you assumed when you answer it is 2.5 years, yes, if that is the case, but I would not think that banks doing it only every 2.5 years. I would imagine it is done at least every year, and therefore I think, okay, this maximum period is maybe 1 year. But I think it is this limiting factor is both when a credit review is done, and based on this review, a bank is making the decision to cancel this facility.
How long you're
and it
exposed.
Is not really what the banks expect, okay, maybe if nothing happens, it is maybe 30 years. I think that exactly, or for me, that was not the period over which we should calculate it. It's then limited to this credit review, however you call it, and then based on this review, you're taking actions, and after these actions, you are not any longer exposed to this credit risk. That was my understanding.
Why I asked how that was being taken into account. If it's okay, George, I'm just going to
yeah.
go to Bill and then back yeah. to you in case Bill has a response to Martin's question.
The nature of the credit card portfolios, they're managed in a subtly different way to the way the sort of corporate type portfolios are managed. The management is much more dynamic than an annual review. You may or may not actually perform an annual review. What you tend to do is to monitor on a monthly basis or even on a sort of transaction. So because so much of the decisioning is automated, you're actually monitoring dynamically what's happening, and you're looking for changes in behavior which might be akin or equivalent to the type of monitoring that takes place on an annual review. But you don't go back to the customer at that point and say, can you give me your details on your income and earnings and all of those other things that you would do there have been changes in circumstances. You're trying to pick that up from the information that you've got and how the facilities are being used, and when people, what sort of information is available at the bureau, credit bureaus, for example. So I just wouldn't want people to go away with the notion that every credit card facility has and is subject to an annual review. It just doesn't work that way.
But that sounded to me like it's subject to a monthly
review. It's monthly, no.
In which case, why are we only going out 30 days? Well, how then is C then would be saying take into account, B5540C would be saying take into account for the credit cards. Every 30 days you've got the opportunity to say I've had enough.
So I remember.
So how are you taking that into account?
Well, sorry, I was going to say what I remember from the discussions as well was how likely is it that the bank is actually going to call the facilities at those times? So that was an important sort of component of that conclusion.
So maybe for a portion of the population, you're saying the 30 days might really.
And that's why I spoke earlier on about the segmentation, because for some customers, so if you think about the population, then Chris said, I don't understand this, cures gets better and sort of gets worse again. But if I land in stage two and I've been in stage two X number of times before, or if I'm landing in stage two and it's the first time that I've ever got there, I'm not necessarily going to manage those two types of customers in quite the same way. I'm going to have different protocols and procedures that I will follow to chase out.
But for me, it is really the main point is, okay, I mean, you're doing certain procedures to identify, okay, maybe the customer has a problem, and after you have identified, you will draw a consequence, maybe to reduce or to cut the line. And that is for me kind of a relevant factor, because when we're discussing not having stake on the contractual term, instead doing something different. That is our discussion. And something different is okay, because if it is not a contractual term, when you ask, maybe then based on your risk management actions, when you then cancel or reduce the lines. And that is for me then, if you're doing that every month, was based on your answer was okay, if I get information from the credit bureau every month, then maybe it is every month, because then hopefully you draw the conclusion.
But I don't quite, what seems to be coming through from what you're saying, I get more flavour of, it's almost like, well, if the bank's got the opportunity to review the credit line every month or every year, then that's setting a limit on how far I look of a month or a year. Yeah. But that's not what the words here say. The words here say, what's the expectations you have around the risk management actions you will take? And I guess if you've got historical data, which presumably reflects your risk management actions, shows that things could bounce around in stage two for a year, or 2 years, or 3 years, go into stage two, come out again, go back again. I mean, that's real information that presumably reflects your expectations and how you actually manage credit risk.
But this is going back to your question about what distinction are we making between the life and the period over which you're exposed to credit risk. And I think it's this idea that, okay, we accepted that it wasn't really one day because you were going to be oblivious to whether things were good or bad. We accepted that. So that made us go beyond the contractual maturity. But I think one of the important things, and maybe it's, you know, appropriately accommodated by segmenting the portfolio, but I think one of the important things that we were trying to focus on, and why the words exposed to credit risk matter, is based on how you manage this credit risk, how frequently do you have the opportunity to get out of that exposure?
But I think the whole thing, exposed to credit risk, but for which expected credit losses would not be mitigated.
Would not be mitigated.
Credit risk management actions.
So maybe that's how they're doing it, but anyway. George.
Well, so, you know, this debate, I think, highlights the fact that there is confusion. I think these folks have spent lots of time with the standard, and there doesn't appear to me to be clear agreement as to where you belong in the spectrum between contractual life and behavioral life. I mean, a lot of people wanted me to ask, so I'll say it, why didn't you guys just pick behavioral life? because everybody seems to understand what that is. It would be more consistent. It would also give you a much larger allowance because those dates would tend to push out for these products. But you chose not to use those words. And so, you know, to me, this issue about, well, maybe it's really it's the period until the next management review or the next management option to cancel comes up, whatever that date is. If it's shorter, then you'll end up with smaller allowances. And if it's longer, and I've got some non-banking clients that issue charge cards that don't look at all. They wait for somebody to become delinquent. There's nothing done in the intervening time. They hope for the best. And so those folks, other things being equal, are going to have much larger reserves because the credit risk management is so radically different. And that's, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But this issue about the fact that none of these words are resonating, and there's I think almost two camps, short period, long period, highlights the need for examples that try to tie this back. Otherwise, all we'll get is inconsistency, and the only way to solve that is disclosures. In the disclosures, you're going to have to disclose what period you use for what product, and if it gets more complicated, to Bill's example, then you'd have to probably try to explain that as well.
That brings a lot of confusion into this example. Is there a difference between considering the loan as a single entity? So I think if you think of it as a single entity, you can understand the limitations and the management actions that happen on a regular basis. As soon as you start looking at your loan on a portfolio basis, even though you have all of these actions going on, what you start to track from a credit management perspective is more the characteristics of the portfolio, which brings you back into this whole concept of a behavioral concept. Because you're not trying to pull out each individual loan. You're trying to look at how does the portfolio collectively behave. And to me, the bit that resonates more is the concept of a behavioral life fits far more with the concept of to which period you're exposed to credit risk. But it only works when you're thinking of a portfolio of loans as opposed to a single loan.
I know that aligns more with what people economically think of, but I'm not sure that was exactly what we were shooting for.
That is not only true for this kind of loans, that is maybe true for a broader.
John.
But if your credit risk management is reactive, which it is on a credit card basis, it has to take into account the delinquency of when the person actually goes bad. So if I've got a credit card and something happens and I miss a payment 2 years in, that's a five-year card. It's irrelevant as to whether someone's tracking on a daily basis what I've been doing. Something happened in 2 years' time which caused me to be delinquent, which caused them to stop the card, which made the period 2.5 years. So you have to take into account that interaction between the actions of the borrower and the reactive nature of how credit cards are measured.
I think that's why
the stratification is trying to get the early ones out, and then you're left with, if you like, in old-fashioned terms, the very good book. But there is a PD on the very good book, and we have to book the lifetime PD on the very good book. So it's trying to stratify the stuff that's going to go bad early. We're left with the balance, and then it's trying to get a practical way to measure that as well, I think.
Graham.
Thanks, Sue. Yeah, kind of dovetailing off of John's comment. Bill, I have a question for you. If you have a borrower that you know is not going to repay your extension of credit to him, are you going to extend him more credit?
If I know that,
yeah.
No.
Okay.
But to Paul's point, on a portfolio, then there will be some customers that will fit that pattern.
Yeah.
So I will measure, manage, monitor those differently.
And that's very much my point, is that I think we're maybe creating a little bit of a false distinction between behavior and rights, because I think they're going to tend to go together on a portfolio basis, that when you have the ability to exercise some right that will limit your credit risk exposure, you will. If you're with a borrower that where credit risk has gone north, and you need to do that. So I think it's sort of a difference without distinction here, because I don't know too many people that say, I've identified you as a borrower who's not going to repay my loan, but I'm going to extend credit to you anyway. And on credit cards and other consumer products, you may not have an actual ability to limit your credit exposure until you've reached that point, right? So I think on a portfolio basis, there really isn't a distinction between behavior and this ability to limit your credit risk.
I think the best thing to do in terms of today's discussion will be in the write-up to emphasise what B5540 says and the fact that there's these three things to consider in this concept of exposure to credit risk, and then I think we'll have to think about what, if anything, we need to do in terms of examples. So we'll leave that as that for the moment. If that's all right with everybody, because I don't think we can go any further where we are today with the words we've got to work with. The second question.
Okay, so the second issue in Agenda Paper 4 relates to how an entity should determine the initial date of recognition of the revolving credit facilities for the purposes of determining whether there has been a significant increase in credit risk. So IFRS 9 requires that at each reporting date, an entity should assess whether the credit risk on a financial instrument has increased significantly since initial recognition. The submitter presents an example of a bank which holds a large portfolio of revolving credit facilities, and the portfolio in question has a diverse customer base ranging from long-standing customers who've been with the bank for many years to new customers who've only recently opened an account. The submitter asks how they would determine the date of initial recognition of the revolving credit facilities in order to determine how to make the assessment of significant increases in credit risks. So there's a number of approaches suggested by the submitter. In the first instance, they focus on determining the date of initial recognition of the original undrawn facility, whereas the other approaches focus on the determination of whether subsequent events, such as the issue of new credit card products, changes to credit limits or revised credit reviews would result in a change in the point used to consider whether there has been a significant increase in credit risk. So the staff will just open this one up for discussion among the members, but before doing that, we'll just point out that under IFRS 9, the assessment of increases in credit risk does focus on the date of initial recognition of the financial instrument which is being accounted for and which is being assessed for significant increases in credit risk. And in this regard, IFRS 9 does provide guidance on the initial recognition date, both for financial assets and for loan commitments, for the purposes of applying the impairment requirements, including guidance on where a financial asset is recognised following a drawdown of a loan commitment. And IFRS 9 also acknowledges that sometimes the renegotiation or modification of a financial asset may sometimes lead to derecognition and sometimes not. But that IFRS 9 did not in any way change the derecognition guidance in IAS 39. So that really is the second issue, and we've touched on it really already as part of the first discussion. So if I could just ask for your views on this one.
And I would have to say for me, this question was sort of on the edge of whether we thought it was an ITG question or not, because it really gets to the heart of recognition and derecognition. I know it has important consequences for the application of the impairment requirements, but it's not expected credit losses per se. But with that caveat, Bill?
Okay, thanks. Yeah, no, thanks. I guess the first thing to say is that, and we've touched on some of this in the earlier discussion, that this is probably one of the biggest operational challenges of implementing IFRS 9 for the revolving credit facilities. And where we've got to in our sort of thinking around this is that the standard is clear, that you go back to when the contract was, when the original card was issued, and only if there's been a substantial modification do you enter into a new arrangement. I spoke about the prototyping that we're doing and the analysis, and so what we're sort of considering is that practically how would we operationalize that, because the scorecards that we would have used when a credit card was first issued, so Stephen sitting next to me, so when Stephen was first a student would have been the point at which he was originally given a credit card. He then sort of got a job, then got married, then had kids, whatever else happens. He's still got that original instrument. The exposure, and this comes back to Martin's point about how you're managing this, the exposure against the instrument might go up and down, so the limit would be increased or decreased depending on changes in circumstances that you became aware of, but you're still back in the old camp. So we sort of took our discussion on a little bit and thought, well, why is it important? Because we're trying to use that initial credit assessment as a point of reference so that we can understand what the changes are going to be. And then we also thought, is that something that is an issue for transition, or is it an issue for ongoing? But we're looking to use a combination of indicators, to the behavior which we've touched on in the card, in terms of if we've got other sort of monitoring which tells us this is a high risk type customer, we would do that, so that we'd supplement whatever we got from the original assessment with what the changes been in behavior period on period to make sure that they remain current and appropriate for when we're reporting the expected credit losses. We're certainly looking at PD assessments by vintages, so when did we originate? Does that enable us to set some sort of absolute thresholds at that point of origination, which we can then use as a reference point so that we can see whether that significant deterioration has been material or not. But I think productionalizing this and sort of trying to identify some of the language has been, well, are we looking to try and capture the jumpers, so the people that go sort of into default pretty quickly, which you would have seen fairly early on in the life, or is it more the sort of the frog in hot water type syndrome where you see this gradual deterioration over time? And so having a reference point which is relevant in terms of capturing that is something we're also looking at. I think one of the other suggestions and discussions that we've had at an industry level is, if you're using that point of initial recognition which the standard requires but you don't have it, are there sensible proxies or alternatives that you could use, such as the PD at the last reporting date, or such as the PD over a different time horizon, which could be used as a proxy to show that comparison? But other components, if you issue a new card, that's not really a new instrument, that's just an operational process, so we saw no change there. I guess I'll stop there.
I guess from my point of view, I think it's largely a question of unit of account, and when you what piece of the facility are you accounting for, I think that's important. This proxy idea, I have to say, probably I didn't have very good face control when you used that example, Bill. Unfortunately, the camera's stuck on me. I'm not sure that's in the spirit.
So he was well there.
On transition, obviously, we've got special accommodation for the fact that we know that people may not have information on the date of initial recognition because it was historical, and there's practical ways around that that at the end up on whether it's low credit risk or not is the cut. But on an ongoing basis, I think saying as a proxy it was the PD as of the last reporting date. I'm not sure that's really in the spirit.
No, but I think it is how to get to picking up on movements period on period, so the significant...
But the requirement is from initial recognition.
No, I understand, but if you didn't have that data going back, then what people are doing is constructing the data.
On transition? Yeah, on transition, that's it. Okay, I didn't see the order, so I'll just go around the table. John?
Paul, first. Oh, Graham, okay. Second, those last.
All right, thank you. Assisting the chair. Paul?
I think Paul described probably the challenge and the thought process quite elegantly. I think the important thing to note is just that the understanding of credit risk based on the stage of the card in terms of its life can be very, very different. And you might... No, the process to actually evaluate at what stage you get a significant increase in credit risk could be substantially different. Now, if you compare a student loan, where you have, for example, a student card, where there's a very low limit, you would allow, I think, much greater flexibility around deterioration in credit risk based on your initial expectations. Whereas if you're looking at a card with the high limit and you're not expecting any adverse behavior, your definition of what you'd consider adverse or deterioration in credit risk would be substantially different.
And I'd agree with that. And that's why I think unit of account's important, because going back to the Steve Cooper example, I would imagine that there's been some point between Steve Cooper student credit card and Steve Cooper's current credit card where there's been a new credit card being accounted for. And so I'm not thinking that we'd start from his, I'm sure, very good quality student credit risk.
You say that, and we do have on the books and records people that have got the same credit card.
It's fine, but I don't think we're locking you into that.
No,
if you
no.
think that there's a more appropriate unit of account, I guess was the only point I was trying to make.
Yeah.
Sorry, Steve. Graham.
Steve, it makes you feel any better. I wasn't very credit worthy as a student either.
But you were.
I know that same credit card. Maybe he is. I mean, Sue and Bernard, first of all, great paper. I think we completely agree with the analysis. I think, to your point, Sue, this is a question really on the border of our charge here as an IDG, because I think the standard is quite clear that it's until you have derecognition, you can't have initial recognition. The question is, when do you have derecognition? What constitutes a significant modification? And, you know, internally we've kicked around within my firm and within the U.S. kicked around some ideas. I mean, clearly, I think when you have a whole new, not just a new physical card, but a whole new credit card system. So you go from a student card to an airline point card. Okay, that seems to be pretty clear. When you just increase and decrease credit limits on the same card, that becomes murky. And although there's certainly, oftentimes there might be a whole credit underwriting process that goes along with that, sometimes there might not be. Is that important? Because it's not, the standard isn't focused on the actions of the lender, it's focused on the modification of the terms of the agreement. So do you even consider the process that the lender goes through to modify the credit? It seems reasonable that you might, because I think the principle behind IFRS 9 is that, you know, or the principle behind the contractual term is that that's when you've re-looked at the credit and you've basically got a new exposure. And it seems like in order to have that, the lender's actions are important, but that's not part of the literature. So it's a difficult question.
Judgment, I think.
Yeah.
John.
Graham's sort of said most of what I was going to say. I mean, it is interesting. I'm happy we're discussing it today, because it is critical to the calculation of these things, and it's critical actually to the first half of the conversation we said, because they really are, it's not perfect sides of the same coin, they're two sides of the same coin. And I think you would take into account your deliberations, you know, credit reviews, but I think just if you do, you might do a credit review and not issue a new card, so that in itself is problematic. Mm-hmm. You might automatically increase a limit because that's what, you know, the market requires in terms of being competitive. You might argue if you double a limit, it may be a different loan, you may not. It's difficult, and I think people are going to have to get to a practical waterline as to what is and isn't, and I think that would be important just as an industry, keep keep close on the arguments to determine when you have a significant change in the cash flows, which would mean you have a derecognition event. But like there needs to be also a practicality brought into it. I think that's what Bill was kind of alluding to when he's looking at PDs. I mean, if your PD has radically decreased over time, it's probably a different card because the risk has changed. So it's just, I think, there's a necessity for a practical overlay here to get this thing to work as well.
I think that the most useful thing we can probably do as a group, if you agree, in terms of sort of noting what our key takeaways would be, is to sort of confirm what was in the analysis of question two in the paper, which is it ultimately comes down to a question of, do you have a new instrument and what's the starting point of this instrument? That we have guidance such as the modifications, that judgments would be involved, but some of the things you might think about, and we can list some of the things that were discussed in the meeting and provide that as a help at the moment. Because I think it needs to be tied in with the sort of recognition concepts, but because IFRS 9 itself isn't black and white about how to do that, the best we can do is to point people to those are the judgments that they should be making judgments to make that assessment, and that's what they should be doing. That I'm hoping that we can declare at lunchtime.